Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Radio Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice. Today, we open our show with some national stories from Public News Service, including a Supreme Court ruling that protects access to an abortion drug for now. A bill that would have protected the right to in vitro fertilization blocked by congressional Republicans, and more. Then on our agricultural report, we'll have the latest on avian flu, which has jumped from birds to cattle to several other mammals, including pet cats and humans, with several farm workers sickened. Find out what you need to know about this illness on our show today. We also have a health alert about shellfish sold in California that's contaminated with toxins causing paralytic poisoning and sometimes death if not promptly treated. In an era of shrinking media outlets, there's a bright spot locally. Times of San Diego has sold to Arizona State University's Newswell, affiliated with the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism. We'll have details on how that will impact local news coverage. Astronaut William Anders, a graduate of Grossmont High School who took the iconic Earthrise photo of the moon during the Apollo 8 mission, has died in a plane crash. And Rubio's, the locally owned chain that made fish tacos famous, has filed for bankruptcy, closing many locations, including one in East County. The U.S. Supreme Court will soon be deciding a key case that could limit the power of environmental regulatory agencies. Locally, a new report on binge and underage drinking has some alarming findings, and we'll have details on that, too. From California News Service, hear about a bill in the state legislature that would divest state pension funds from the fossil fuel industry. San Diego County is a hub for human trafficking, and now the county is launching a new awareness campaign to protect young people from becoming victims. SDG&E is warning about scammers posing as utility workers in phone calls to ratepayers. The City of El Cajon invites residents to town hall meetings on a sales tax measure that's about to expire and the consequences for the community if voters don't extend that half-cent tax. The Water Conservation Garden is growing its revenues again after briefly closing its doors earlier this year and has an army of volunteers, but more help is needed to provide seed money for long-term sustainability. The state's Market Match program, which helps low-income people buy food at farmers' market, is on the chopping block in budget negotiations in Sacramento. And as summer fast approaches, the county has cool zones available to beat the heat. Finally, hear an inspiring story about an East County veteran participating in the upcoming Warrior Challenge Games. So stay tuned for the East County Magazine Radio Show on KNSJ, where East County matters.
Welcome to 2024 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
No one should be celebrating this decision. This decision should have been an obvious one. And let us not forget, this decision was based not on the merits, but on a lack of standing. We are not yet out of the woods.
Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer says Democrats will have to defend the right of women and their doctors to make reproductive health decisions. The Supreme Court ruled unanimously that a pro-life group failed to show they were harmed by the FDA expanding access to abortion drug mifepristone, but the court didn't rule on the substance of the case. In another post-Roe dispute, Senate Republicans are blocking a bill to protect access to IVF. Pennsylvania Democratic Representative Susan Wild says attacks on reproductive care have spiked since Alabama Supreme Court ruled all embryos have rights, effectively banning the fertility treatment there.
Women's autonomy to make their own medical decisions should not be up for debate, and their bodies should not be pawns used by politicians to score cheap political points.
In the coming weeks, the U.S. Supreme Court could overturn or modify what's known as the Chevron deference. Currently, courts defer to federal agencies in sorting out ambiguities in areas they regulate, but Jim Murphy with the National Wildlife Federation says this conservative majority has shown an eagerness to limit the power of executive departments.
We're already seeing the effects of a court with an anti-regulatory bent ignoring the agencies and ignoring science and defining terms in ways that it views as favorably.
New filings show Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas took more free trips paid for by a conservative mega donor than he previously disclosed, some worth millions. Democratic Whip and Senate Judiciary Chair Dick Durbin says it's time for legislation with a binding code of ethics, including stricter transparency and new recusal requirements.
This legislation's ethical and recusal requirements would apply to every justice on the Supreme Court, regardless of the party of the president who appointed them. This should not be a partisan issue.
Wisconsin's state Supreme Court is banning mobile voting locations to cheers from conservatives. The court did keep rules letting clerks choose alternate absentee voting sites, and University of Wisconsin political scientist Barry Burden says they should still be able to sort out the complicated logistics.
They face a lot of difficulties trying to find sites that are available. They're often repurposing a church or a school or a community building.
Some universities are scrambling to shift their budgets as lawmakers ban funding for diversity programs. According to a new report from the American Association of University Professors, state lawmakers have filed more than 150 bills aimed at college governance and academic freedom since 2021. Isaac Kamala is with the AAUP.
The teaching and research that takes place within those institutions has to be free from external pressures to ensure that what takes place in the classroom and research pursues truth wherever it leads, not where those with political and economic power wishes.
I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
How you gonna keep 'em down on the farm after
This is Miriam Raftery with East County Magazine's Agricultural Report. Dairy farmers throughout the nation are on guard, and the federal government is mobilizing after an outbreak among cattle herds of highly pathogenic avian influenza, once thought to be confined to poultry flocks. What's more, the virus known as H5N1 or bird flu has been diagnosed in 3 dairy farm workers, causing respiratory symptoms and, in one case, pink eye in these human victims. The notable leap from cows and chickens to humans is not yet ringing alarm bells for public health officials or veterinarians who believe the risk to the general public remains low, but they are closely monitoring poultry and dairy farms for any changes, despite a reluctance among some dairy farmers to test their herds. Marcus Plushia, Chief Medical Officer for the Association of State and Territorial Health Officers, says avian influenza is something that public health scientists are worried about, adding, if this did get into a place where it was easily transmissible among humans, everybody fears that could be a really, really bad scenario, the Kansas Reflector reports. The ongoing response has brought together a variety of government agencies and agricultural organizations seeking to stem the significant economic toll that farmers could face and to curb the virus spread. At the federal level, the Agriculture Department is responsible for the farm animals. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention for Human Health, the Food and Drug Administration, has jurisdiction over the eggs and milk sold in grocery stores, and the Administration for Strategic Preparedness and Response oversees its piece of the pie. Then come the state agencies, interest groups, agribusiness, and family farms. Now, as of last week, more than 40 people had been tested for H5N1, with more than 350 people enrolled in monitoring. About 220 of those are in Michigan. 2 of the human cases have been in Michigan, while the other was in Texas. Michigan also has several dairy cattle herds diagnosed with the disease. The USDA has performed over 17,000 tests on cattle so far, with a total of 67 herds affected throughout 9 states, although so far, California is not one of them. This strain of bird flu has also cropped up in a wide variety of mammals, including domestic cats. That's led experts to recommend that people limit their pets' interactions with wild birds, which hold a reservoir of the virus, as well as farm animals. The U.S. Department of Agriculture is launching a voluntary pilot program to expand testing for dairy farms to gain better insight into the virus and make it easier for farmers to ship healthy dairy cows across state lines. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack told reporters on a press call, "We have a pretty good understanding of the nature of this virus and essentially what's causing its spread," adding, "We're trying to essentially corner this virus so that over time it dissipates." Dairy farmers can begin enrolling in the pilot program this week in participating states. But there's reluctance among some dairy farmers to voluntarily test their cattle for fear of what might happen if tests reveal their herds are infected, says Dr. Barb Peterson, a Texas veterinarian who helped discover the bird flu was infecting cattle. They might be afraid they'll be barred from selling their cattle for an unknown amount of time, or that animal movements to and from their farms will be restricted. Peterson suspects that nearly all the dairies in her area near Amarillo, Texas, were infected, but that many were not tested. Infected cows typically recover in about 10 to 14 days. Infected herds suffer a drop in milk production that can last about a month. The virus is much more severe, however, for chicken and turkey flocks, where it often causes fatal illness. Entire flocks are destroyed when it's diagnosed to prevent the spread of the deadly virus. More testing and better biosecurity measures are important to help prevent the virus from spreading from infected cattle to the poultry flocks, according to Philip Jardin, the dairy extension veterinarian for Iowa State University. He says some dairy farms have installed noise-making systems to keep away wild birds, which are believed to be an initial source of infections. The risk to dairies is not as large as it is to poultry, he says, but dairies should keep in mind that they have neighbors who are poultry producers where it can be devastating, and they don't want to have a local source of the virus. Secretary Vilsack wants the USDA to better educate dairy farmers about the risks to their neighboring farmers to get more voluntary help in tracking and containing the virus. It spread from Texas to faraway states through the transportation of infected cattle, but it has likely spread locally via farm workers, veterinarians, and equipment moving farm to farm, Vilsack says. Ensuring farm workers have access to personal protective equipment is essential, though it could be challenging to get all workers to use it during hot summer weather. Public health officials aim to work with farm owners and farm workers to make sure that even people with mild symptoms get tested for avian flu, and to assure undocumented farm workers or those on agricultural work visas that there's nothing to fear in getting tested. Now, for the public, it's important to know that health experts are urging consumers not to drink raw milk, which can transmit bird flu to humans. Also, don't feed raw milk to pets, since this strain of avian flu has been spread among mammals, including raccoons, foxes, mountain lions, and domestic pets, including cats. Pasteurized milk purchased in grocery stores is safe to drink and has been repeatedly tested by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration during the past few months to ensure that there's no active virus in the nation's food supply. The story is based on reporting in the Kansas Reflector. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, bringing you public interest news from our region.
This is John Tidwell with a health alert. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration is warning consumers, restaurants, and food retailers not to eat, serve, or sell oysters, clams, or other shellfish recently harvested from specific areas in Oregon and Washington in late May due to contamination with a toxin that causes paralytic poisoning, which can result in death quickly if untreated, especially in children. The shellfish were distributed in at least 9 states, including California. The areas where tainted shellfish originated include Tillamook Bay and Neatharts Bay in Oregon, as well as Willapa Bay, Stony Point, Bay Center, and Bruceport in Washington State. Contamination of mollusks can occur due to toxic algae in the waters. The contaminated shellfish may look, smell, and taste normal. The toxins cannot be removed by cooking or freezing. Paralytic shellfish poisoning can cause symptoms quickly, within 30 minutes, including numbness of arms and legs, mouth tingling, shortness of breath, respiratory paralysis, dizziness, headaches, vomiting, loss of muscle coordination, and death. Immediate emergency medical treatment, including respiratory support and fluid therapy, is vital, since patients who survive for 24 hours have a good prognosis, usually without lasting side effects. Consult your healthcare provider immediately if you have symptoms of paralytic shellfish poisoning after eating or having contact with shellfish.
At a time when many media outlets are closing down, cutting coverage, or selling out to corporate interests and venture capitalists, there's a bright spot in our local media landscape. Times of San Diego has been acquired by Newswell, an innovative nonprofit organization that's actually dedicated to supporting and strengthening local news outlets. Newswell is part of Arizona State University's media enterprise. The university has been recognized for its innovative approaches and is home to one of the nation's premier journalism schools, the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism and Mass Communication. Times of San Diego will continue to be based in San Diego with local reporting and editing while gaining access to shared resources, best practices, industry innovations, and new opportunities for revenue and digital advancements essential for growth and sustainability. While Times of San Diego concentrates on delivering quality, community-focused news in San Diego, Newswell focuses on delivering and improving business services to media organizations. The pioneering nonprofit aims to use its expertise to develop innovative, sustainable solutions to the publishing and operations of small and mid-sized news organizations. Chris Jennerwine, editor and general manager of Times of San Diego, says this is a unique opportunity to build on what Times of San Diego has created over the last decade. As part of Newswell, we'll seek to define the future of local media in today's digital environment, he adds. The San Diego Press Club has judged Times of San Diego the best local news website in 7 of the last 8 years. Part of the mission of Arizona State University, the nation's largest public university, is to advance research and discovery of public value and assume responsibility for the economic, social, and cultural health of the communities it serves. That's a key driver for Newswell, as more than half of the counties in the United States now have just one or no local news outlet, according to Northwestern University research. These news deserts are not good for a strong society and democracy, and Newswell is focused on stabilizing and strengthening local news organizations in thriving communities. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso in the heart of San Diego's East County.
Astronaut William Anders, the 1951 Grossmont High School graduate who took what may be the most famous photo of Earth during the history-making Apollo 8 mission, has died at age 90. Ironically, the local astronaut who flew to the moon and back died when a single-engine plane he was piloting crashed offshore near Seattle, Washington. Anders lived in Washington State's San Juan Islands and also had a home in Point Loma. His son, retired Air Force Lieutenant Colonel Greg Anders, confirmed the death to the Associated Press. He said of his father, "He was a great pilot, and we will miss him terribly." Anders' photo of a blue Earth rising over the barren surface of the moon became an icon of the environmental movement. The photo was taken as Apollo 8 rounded the far side of the moon in December 1968. It was the first mission to circumnavigate the moon and the first time that humans had seen an Earthrise. Anders famously recited the first line of Genesis to a worldwide audience on Christmas Eve 1968 and later founded the Heritage Flight Museum in Washington State. Anders said of his historic space flight, "We came all this way to explore the moon, and the most important thing is that we discovered the Earth." In December 2021, Anders spoke in San Diego at the Air and Space Museum on the 118th anniversary of the Wright brothers' first flight, Times of San Diego reports. Anders said that despite billionaires' ambitions of colonizing Mars in their lifetimes, he doubted it would happen in the next century. "I frankly think that it is going to be much more difficult to go to Mars than NASA is admitting or Elon Musk is admitting," he said, noting hardships including zero gravity and space radiation. Noting the advances in technology since the Wright brothers' 12-horsepower engine when they made their first flight in 1903, Anders predicted that technology will keep leapfrogging year after year in exponential increases. The astronaut was born in Hong Kong, the son of a Navy officer awarded the Navy Cross after an early battle with Japanese forces. The family relocated to La Mesa, where Anders graduated from Grossmont High School and then the U.S. Naval Academy at Annapolis. Though he initially followed his father into the Navy, Anders later joined the Air Force, flying fighter jets before becoming a test pilot and then a NASA astronaut. He retired from the Air Force Reserve as a major general. After NASA, he served in various government roles, including chairman of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. He entered the business world with positions at General Electric, Textron, and General Dynamics, where he ultimately became chairman and CEO. William Anders is survived by his wife, Valerie Anders, 4 sons, Greg, Alan, Glenn, and Eric, 2 daughters, Gail and Diana, and 13 grandchildren. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is John Tidwell.
A free press is the foundation of our democracy. KNSJ Radio is dedicated to providing nonprofit news in the public interest, not special interests. We rely on your support to continue bringing you important stories from San Diego and East County that you won't hear anywhere else. Please make a generous donation at knsj.org to sustain KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.
The company that made fish tacos a household phrase at its fast casual restaurants and airport outlets across the nation now finds itself underwater financially. Rubio's Coastal Grill, headquartered in Carlsbad, has filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy after closing 48 of its California locations, with 13 in San Diego County, including El Cajon's Parkway Plaza in East County. Rubio's Restaurants, parent company of the fast casual chain, announced it hopes to sell the business founded in 1983 and indicated it will continue operating the remaining 86 locations in California, Arizona, and Nevada. This is the second time the company has filed for bankruptcy. The first, in 2020, was due to the COVID-19 pandemic. This time, California's minimum wage hike for fast food workers to $20 an hour starting in April has added to the company's financial woes, ABC 10 News reports. Nicholas Rubin, chief restructuring officer at Rubio's Coastal Grill, says the company has a strong and loyal customer base, but he adds, despite the company's best efforts to right-size the company, the continuing challenging economic conditions have negatively impacted its ability to meet the demands of its debt burden. The company believes the best path forward for Rubio's is through a court-supervised sale process, in hopes that it will position the brand for long-term success.
This is East County Magazine's Crime Beat. On the streets, reporting on crimes impacting communities across our region, helping to keep you safe and informed.
This is John Tidwell with a Crime Beat report. In sweeping raids across multiple counties, including San Diego this past week, 400 officers from dozens of agencies arrested 36 members of the Sinaloa cartel. Those arrested were involved in a large-scale fentanyl and methamphetamine distribution network based in Imperial Valley, according to the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Southern District of California. Charges were filed against 47 alleged members of the criminal operation, including 11 who remain fugitives from justice. Those arrested included Alexander Grindley, who was accused of meth trafficking while working as a U.S. Border Patrol agent. Also arrested in the sweep, or named in the indictments, were two East County residents, 36-year-old Corey Gershon of Jacumba and 37-year-old Yomira Patricia Penuelas of El Cajon. The raids seized about 2 million doses of fentanyl, nearly 9 pounds, as well as 714 pounds of methamphetamine. In addition, 52 firearms were confiscated, including multiple AR-style weapons, as well as pistols, unfinished firearm parts used to create ghost guns, and Russian-made ammunition. U.S. Attorney Merrick Garland says, with this takedown, the Justice Department has dealt yet another blow to the Sinaloa cartel and its associates. Dozens of agencies, including Homeland Security, the Drug Enforcement Agency, Border Patrol, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, and the San Diego County Sheriff's Department coordinated on the busts in San Diego, Imperial County, Fresno, Los Angeles, Phoenix, and Salem, Oregon, according to the District Attorney's Office.
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community.
The the Supreme Court is expected to rule any day now on two cases that could allow judges to more easily overrule federal agencies, which could have big implications for environmental, consumer, and public health protections. The two cases aim to overturn the 1984 Chevron deference doctrine that said when ambiguous statutes are being challenged in court, judges must defer to the reasonable interpretation of agency experts. Jim Murphy is with the National Wildlife Federation.
It would give judges a lot more power to write very impactful regulatory provisions where those judges really don't have a lot of expertise.
Opponents of the Chevron deference doctrine say it gives too much power to the executive branch. The cases stem from a dispute where fishing crews are challenging requirements that they pay to have a monitor on board to guard against overfishing and bycatch of endangered species. Murphy says if the Supreme Court invalidates the Chevron deference doctrine, it would undermine the work of dozens of agencies, including the EPA, the FDA, the Federal Trade Commission, and the Federal Communications Commission.
The people who are charged with protecting our public health, protecting our natural resources, are not going to have the tools they need. And it's going to result in people getting sick, people dying, places getting polluted. It's going to have real impact for a very long time.
The Supreme Court generally releases its decisions in mid-June before going into recess for the summer. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
The San Diego County Binge and Underage Drinking Initiative has released a report shedding light on disturbing trends of alcohol consumption in the community. Binge drinking and underage drinking are pervasive issues. Binge drinking is consuming five or more drinks on an occasion for men or four or more drinks for women. Nationally, one in six adults report binge drinking, with a quarter of them doing so weekly. In California, 19% of adults admitted to binge drinking in the last month, with San Diego County surpassing that figure at 21%. Despite common misconceptions, most binge drinkers are not alcohol dependent. However, the consequences of binge drinking are severe, contributing to injuries, chronic diseases, and a higher risk of developing alcohol use disorders. Underage drinking is linked to over 3,900 deaths among those under age 21 in the U.S. Peer influence and parental behavior play critical roles in shaping youth drinking habits. A 5% increase in adult binge drinking in a community correlates with a 12% rise in underage drinking in the same area. In 2022, nearly 9% of teens in San Diego County reported binge drinking in the past month, while over 25% had consumed alcohol at some point. These rates are higher than the state averages. The report also draws attention to the dangerous intersection of drinking and driving. From 2018 to 2022, the percentage of motor vehicle collisions involving a drinking driver in San Diego County surged by 34.9%. Particularly concerning is the 46.1% increase in underage drinking drivers involved in these incidents. Medical encounters with alcohol poisoning present another critical concern. Although the rates of such incidents have dropped from 2017 to 2021, they remain high. Adults over 21 are significantly more likely to experience alcohol poisoning, with emergency department discharges three times higher than those for underage drinkers. The report emphasizes the need for a multi-agency approach to combat these issues. By promoting safe and healthy behaviors and addressing the root causes of substance misuse, the initiative aims to reduce alcohol-related harms across San Diego County. Community-based and environmental strategies are essential in this endeavor. These include educational programs, stricter enforcement of underage drinking laws, and initiatives that foster healthier social norms. The binge and underage drinking initiatives are part of a comprehensive countywide prevention system aiming to address the underlying causes of substance misuse and substance use disorders, funded by San Diego County's Health and Human Services. David Shorey with the Institute for Public Policy and a columnist for East County Magazine says the findings of the new drinking report are a call to action. While progress is evident in some areas, the persistent and pervasive nature of binge and underage drinking requires a continued and concerted effort from all community stakeholders, he says, adding, through collaborative prevention strategies and a commitment to healthier environments, San Diego County can make significant strides toward mitigating the harms associated with excessive alcohol use. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
This is John Tidwell with a public service announcement from San Diego County Library. Do you or your children like to read, learn, and earn prizes? This summer, you can do all three. The County Library Summer Learning Challenge is back. This summer's challenge runs now through August 31st. Register online or at any of the 33 county libraries, read some books, have some fun, engage in some new activities, and you could just earn a prize, from achievement badges to a new book or your choice of a library tote bag. The Summer Challenge is open to people of all ages, but its main goal is to encourage kids and teens to read during their summer vacations. That can help prevent what some educators call the summer slide, where students can lose some of what they achieved during the school year. Taking part is easy. Just come into your local library to register or do it online. First, pick up a printed learning log in any of the 8 languages at a county library branch, or print one out at home to track your progress. Then, over the 3-month challenge, track what you read and mark the activities you complete in the log to win prizes. Activities can include answering questions, submitting a drawing, or trying out a new recipe. You can win achievement badges by completing educational activities, reading books, spending hours reading, submitting book reviews, or a combination of those. You don't even have to come into the library to check out books or read, since the county's e-book collection is available to everyone using your library card through the library's online OverDrive platform or by downloading the Libby app and connecting to the library. If you don't already have a county library card, you can do that online or at a branch just by using your cell phone number. To sign up for the Summer Learning Challenge, drop into any county library branch or visit the San Diego County Library site, sdcl.org/summer.
The East County Magazine Show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interest, not special interest. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. Now stay tuned for part 2 of the East County Magazine Radio Show.
You're listening to the East County Magazine Radio Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, bringing you public interest news for San Diego's inland region. Now, stay tuned for part 2 of the East County Magazine Radio Show.
Imagine coming home after a long day, greeted by your loyal companion who offers you comfort and joy. For many, this scenario involves a beloved pet, but for others, this comes from an emotional support animal. While pets and emotional support animals might seem similar at first glance, they play very different roles according to fair housing laws. Understanding this difference is crucial for ensuring equal housing opportunities for everyone. Pets are animals kept primarily for companionship and enjoyment. They include dogs, cats, birds, fish, and more exotic creatures. Pets are subject to the rules and policies set by landlords and housing providers. Landlords can impose breed restrictions, size limits, and pet fees or deposits. Emotional support animals are more than just companions. They provide therapeutic benefits to individuals with mental or emotional disabilities, helping alleviate symptoms and improve well-being. Unlike service animals, which are specially trained to perform tasks for people with disabilities, emotional support animals do not require specific training. Their mere presence provides comfort and support. Now, here's where fair housing comes into play. Under the Fair Housing Act, people with disabilities have the right to request reasonable accommodations for their emotional support animals. This means that even if a housing provider has a no-pets policy, they must allow an emotional support animal if the individual provides appropriate documentation from a licensed healthcare professional. Landlords cannot impose pet fees, breed restrictions, or other pet-related policies on emotional support animals. Denying a reasonable accommodation request can lead to legal consequences for the landlord. To qualify for an emotional support animal, tenants must provide documentation from a healthcare professional that confirms their disability and the need for this emotional support animal. Housing providers can request this documentation, but they cannot ask for extensive medical records or detailed information about the type of disability. Housing providers must handle emotional support animal requests on a case-by-case basis and avoid blanket policies that could inadvertently discriminate against people with disabilities. If you or anyone you know has questions on emotional support animals, you can reach out to CSA San Diego. CSA is a nonprofit organization built on emphasizing fair housing laws through programs, advocacy, and services that actively work against discrimination in housing. You can visit their website at c4sa.org to find out more or call 619-444-5700. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery.
State lawmakers are considering a bill that would require two public pension systems to pull about $15 billion in combined investments from the fossil fuel industry by 2031. Senate Bill 252 would affect the California Public Employee Retirement System, called CalPERS, and the California State Teachers Retirement System, or CalSTRS. State Senator Lena Gonzalez represents Long Beach and says divestment is a moral imperative.
We cannot leave our kids with climate risk. And I see the impacts every day. I see the pollution in my neighborhood, the asthma and respiratory illnesses, all of it.
CalPERS governing board opposes the measure, arguing their first responsibility is to maximize returns and that the companies would find other, less socially conscious investors. Last November, CalPERS released a summary of a plan to move the portfolio towards net zero by 2050, where carbon emissions from investments are evenly balanced with carbon reductions. SB 252 has passed the state Senate and is now before the Assembly Committee on Public Employment and Retirement. Gonzalez argues it's fiscally irresponsible to invest pension funds in companies such as Exxon, Chevron, BP, and ConocoPhillips, calling them some of the state's largest polluters.
It's a volatile commodity. We know that it's also on its way to being divested across the globe. We don't want to leave pensioners with these stranded assets and horrible risks financially down the road.
Hawaii, Massachusetts, Maine, New Jersey, New York, Oregon, and Vermont are among the states that have already moved to divest their pension funds or are considering legislation to do so. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
The county is rolling out a media campaign designed to raise public awareness about human trafficking. The educational campaign includes radio announcements, billboards, and digital media to inform children, youth, and their peers on how to protect themselves from exploitation. The new campaign was announced at a press conference by Chairwoman Nora Vargas, Supervisor Jim Desmond, and District Attorney Summer Steffen, along with other county leaders. Human trafficking occurs when a person is forced into sex acts or labor services for profit through violence, threats, and false promises. The FBI reports that San Diego is one of the nation's 13 hot spots for human trafficking. Nora Vargas, chairwoman of the County Board of Supervisors, says trafficking of children and young people happens in all neighborhoods and victims can be any age, race, gender, or nationality. Language barriers and fear too often keep victims silent and make trafficking a hidden crime, she warns. A recent study by two local universities estimates there are thousands of victims of trafficking annually here in San Diego, and the average age of victims is 16 years old, and sometimes far younger. Rarely is the victim kidnapped. Rather, human traffickers are far more likely to lure their young victims by developing a relationship with the youth, oftentimes via social media. East County Supervisor Jim Desmond says, predators target young girls and boys, subjecting them to a life of sexual exploitation through coercion and manipulation. These victims are thrust into an abyss of despair, their dreams and aspirations shattered and replaced with unimaginable suffering, he adds. Law enforcement and prosecution efforts alone are not enough to stop these human rights violations. Prevention through education, especially at a young age, is the best defense against exploitation, especially in this era of social media. District Attorney Summer Steffen explains, traffickers often groom, deceive, and control their victims through online platforms. Our youth need to be aware of predators posing as friends. the county's media campaign will run this summer in English and Spanish. If you suspect child abuse or neglect, please call the Child Abuse Hotline at 858-560-2191, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Again, that number is 858-560-2191. And you can find more about human trafficking on the San Diego County District Attorney's website. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery. Now it's time for East County Magazine's Scammers, Schemers, and Swindlers report, shining a light on shady deals all around us. This is Miriam Raftery with a warning about a new scam targeting customers of San Diego Gas and Electric Company. To protect customers, SDG&E is alerting them to a recently documented text message utility scam trying to defraud local utility customers. The scheme attempts to exploit SDG&E's legitimate use of text messages and email notifications to inform residential customers of work orders like meter changes, meter reads, and testing. There is an important distinction between a fraudulent and a legitimate customer communication. The fraudster will route the customer to a fake 1-800 phone number. Legitimate SDG&E texts will always point the customer to SDG&E's main customer care center. That number is 1-800-411-7343. And when in doubt, just hang up and call SDG&E back at the number that's listed on SDG&E's webpage, sdge.com. Here's how the scam unfolds. It starts with a text message that includes an SDG&E logo and says that there's an immediate work order to disconnect power at the address on file. The scammer asks the customer to call a scammer-run call center to confirm the work order. When the customer places the call, they briefly hear a recorded message. Welcome to the SDG&E call center. You are the first in the queue. After hold music, a live fraudster attempts to demand immediate payment to stop the power from being disconnected. Targeted customers are then asked to pay in non-traceable Bitcoin, Zelle, Green Dot debit cards, or other non-traditional forms of payment that SDG&E does not use. Compounding the loss, targets are repeatedly told the payment did not go through and they may unwittingly repeat the financial transaction. Victims are told to keep trying because any amount overpaid will just result in an expedited refund. The losses can be staggering. Those most prone to fraud include restaurant owners, small businesses, homeowner associations, older adults, and limited English speakers. Fraudsters prey on victims whose livelihood depends on a consistent source of electricity. For example, the fraudsters have been known to call restaurateurs just before the lunch hour to add pressure. The owner, experiencing the noontime rush, complies with the fraudulent demand for payment all too often. Now remember these tips to avoid becoming a victim. SDG&E will never call to demand immediate payment made over the phone with the threat of an immediate service disconnection. SDG&E will never accept any payment over the phone, so anybody requesting payment over the phone is an imposter. The only utility bill payment options are My Account, a branch office location, or an authorized payment location. SDG&E does not accept prepaid cash cards, Zelle, Green Dot, or Bitcoin for bill payments. The utility company will never demand cash in person. Never provide your utility bill information to anyone you do not know. Never give anyone your online utility login credentials. Do not use the callback number provided by an unknown caller. Always find the official contact information from verified sources, such as SDG&E's website, as we mentioned. Do have a conversation about utility scams with older family members and friends to ensure that they do not fall victim. And don't forget, you can always check your bill and payment history at sdge.com/myaccount. For more information about scams, you can visit sdge.com/scams.
The City of El Cajon's special sales tax measure, Proposition J, is set to expire, and voters may soon be asked whether to approve extending the half-cent sales tax in the future. The city invites residents to 4 town halls to learn about the services provided through the half-cent sales tax and what services may have to be cut if the funding source is not continued. Each town hall will include an interactive budgeting activity that will provide vital feedback to city leaders. The town halls scheduled are June 13th at 6 p.m. at Bostonia Recreation Center, June 15th at 1 p.m. in the Ronald Reagan Community Center, June 18th at 6 p.m. in the Kennedy Recreation Center, and June 20th at 6 p.m. at Hillsdale Recreation Center. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is John Tidwell.
Seeds of change have been planted at the Water Conservation Garden at Cuyamaca College in Rancho San Diego. The garden's Joint Powers Authority, or JPA, has taken over management and operations, while the nonprofit Friends of the Water Conservation declared bankruptcy after becoming mired in debt due to large loans when it ran the garden. Hope is blossoming now among JPA members and a growing group of about 60 volunteers who have stepped up to fill key needs. Expenditures have been pruned and revenues are on the rise, though major funding is still needed for long-term sustainability. At its meeting on June 7th, the JPA approved a budget of over $589,000 for fiscal year 2024-25. Of that, though, only an estimated $84,000 is projected to be covered from revenues such as donations, memberships, events, gift shop, and plant sales. The remaining $500,000 would be covered by the five JPA member water agencies, unless additional revenue sources can be found. The monkey wrench in the works, however, is that the Sweetwater Water Authority is planning to pull out of the JPA. JPA Chairman Mark Roback told East County Magazine, Sweetwater Authority has already voted to put in their one-year withdrawal letter come July 1st, so the rubber has to meet the road here in the next year, he said, noting the need to attract new JPA members and other long-term funding sources. The development piece of this is front and center, he emphasized. Still, there is plenty to be optimistic about. After closing its doors briefly in February, the garden is once again thriving in terms of attendance, membership, and enthusiasm. The gift shop has reopened, run by volunteers, selling handmade products crafted by volunteers. Media coverage and social media have brought visitors from across the region. Yoga classes are back. A butterfly release is planned. More major events such as weddings are being booked, and the garden is planning a November celebration of its 25th anniversary. Employee costs are down by more than two-thirds, and inflated expenditures have been reduced. Bankruptcy of the Friends Group and the change of organizational leadership also uproots responsibility for repaying nearly $1 million in loans that the Friends Group incurred during and after COVID. The newly approved budget calls for 3 full-time and 3 part-time employees, up from just 2 employees the past few months, Interim Director Lauren Magnuson and Facilities Manager Tim Townsley. At the June 7th JPA meeting, numerous volunteers spoke during public comments to praise the efforts of Magnuson and Townsley, urging that both be retained and that Magnuson be named executive director. Now, the actual staff titles authorized in the budget for full-time positions are Chief Executive Officer, Garden Administration Manager, and Garden Operations Maintenance Manager. 2 part-time maintenance and 1 part-time administrative position were also approved. Roback envisions Magnuson as the full-time garden administration manager, earning more than she does now. Adding a CEO as well could bring on expertise in business management, fundraising, and outreach to provide long-term sustainability, he believes. Roback made clear that the success in improving the garden's financial outlook and morale has been a team effort, however, doling out praise for the JPA members, the volunteers, Magnuson, Townsley, and others. JPA board member Kathleen Hedberg from Helix Water District praised everyone who has worked to achieve what she calls fabulous results in such a short time frame, recalling the dire straits when the garden closed its doors briefly just a few months ago. Rachel McCurry praised Magnuson for integrity, saying she's an incredibly hard worker, as well as motivating volunteers. What a gift we have found in Lauren, she concluded. Rosalie Dosica called Magnuson the best director ever, and noted that outreach to media has boosted attendance so much that the garden is no longer a hidden gem, she suggested. Emily Routman, who has served as consultant for the San Diego Zoo Global Alliance and other nonprofits, called Magnuson among the most effective executives she's dealt with. The best person for this job is already on the job, she told the JPA board. It is unclear who might be tapped to fill the 4 new staff positions approved in the budget, including the CEO slot. But if funds can be raised to sustain not only retaining Magnuson and Townsley, but also adding more staff with expertise to grow revenues exponentially, the result could be a hybrid business model that will enable the garden to thrive and delight future generations. If you would like to visit the Water Conservation Garden or donate to help it thrive, you can go to thegarden.org. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
A free press is the foundation of our democracy. KNSJ Radio is dedicated to providing nonprofit news in the public interest, not special interests. We rely on your support to continue bringing you important stories from San Diego and East County that you won't hear anywhere else. Please make a generous donation at knsj.org to sustain KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.
California anti-hunger groups are asking Governor Gavin Newsom to preserve funding for Market Match, a program that helps low-income families buy fruits and vegetables at farmers markets. Lawmakers are expected to include $35 million for the program when they pass a budget this weekend. Minnie Foreman with the Ecology Center hopes the governor will decide to leave it be.
He could, in the final hour, strip it out. And all of our hard work and all the hard work of all of the elected officials and advocates would be lost.
Lawmakers face a multi-billion-dollar deficit and are required by law to pass a balanced budget. The governor's budget proposals in January and May essentially zeroed out Market Match, but the lawmakers' version restored the California Nutrition Incentive Program, which funds Market Match. Frank Tamborello with Hunger Action LA says Market Match helps families cope with rising food prices, and that's just the beginning.
It's fighting hunger. It's promoting healthy foods. It's helping the California small farm economy. And in the long run, it's also helping with sustainable agriculture and climate change by reducing the number of miles that the food travels to get to you.
Market Match has been around for 15 years and is now offered at almost 300 sites around the state. The program gives people on CalFresh about $15 per market per day to spend on fruits and vegetables. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
Our East County Magazine radio show needs volunteers, and so does our award-winning news website at eastcountymagazine.org. If you would like to help write scripts, learn reporting skills, research topics for our news team, or have an on-air voice to be the media, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617.
In the good old summertime, in the good old summertime, strolling through the shady lane with your baby mine.
With summer just around the corner, the County of San Diego has opened its annual Cool Zones program, giving people free, safe, air-conditioned sanctuaries to escape extreme heat. The county created the Cool Zone program 2 decades ago to give older adults, people with disabilities, and those with health concerns that could be complicated by effects of extreme heat. The program will run from June 1st through October 31st. Sites include the county's 33 branch libraries, community centers, and other locations across the county, including here in East County. A complete list of Cool Zone sites, hours, and locations is located online at coolzones.org. That site includes a map where you can type in your address and find locations near you. You can also call 211 to find a location, or if you can't get to a cool zone, you can even ask for help with free transportation. Extreme heat can be very dangerous for older adults and children especially, and everybody is recommended to shelter in cool locations when the temperature gets too hot. Working or exercising outside on a hot day or staying in a hot space too long can cause heat-related illnesses from cramps to exhaustion to heat stroke, a condition when the body can no longer control its own temperature. Signs of heat stroke or exhaustion include having an extremely high body temperature, 103 degrees or higher, dizziness, nausea, confusion, and headache. Anybody suffering those symptoms should call 911 and be cooled off immediately. Now, in addition to providing cool zone locations, the county, working with San Diego Gas and Electric, is now providing free electric fans to older or disabled San Diegans living on limited incomes. To be eligible for the fan program, county residents must be 60 years or older or disabled, living on a limited income, must not have access to an air-conditioned space at their home or apartment building, and be unable to travel to a cool zone site. To learn more about the Cool Zone fan program or to request a fan, you can call 211 or visit coolzones.org. The Cool Zone program is operated by the County Health and Human Services Agency. For more information about the Cool Zones program, as well as tips to stay cool at home and locations near you, again, that website is coolzones.org. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, in the heart of San Diego's East County.
After another wet winter, warming temperatures and winds are quickly drying out grass and brush. The increasing fire danger posed by the high volume of dead grass and hotter, drier conditions in the region has prompted CAL FIRE to suspend all burn permits for outdoor residential burning within the state responsibility area of San Diego County. This suspension takes effect at 8 a.m. June 1st and suspends all residential outdoor burning of landscape debris such as branches and leaves. Fire Chief Tony Meacham says this measure is essential to safeguard our communities and resources during this heightened period of danger. Since January 1st, CAL FIRE and firefighters across the state have already responded to over 1,250 wildfires. CAL FIRE is asking residents to be prepared for wildfires by maintaining a minimum of 100 feet of defensible space around each home and building on their property, and being prepared to evacuate if needed. After clearing dead or dying vegetation, landscape with fire-resistant plants and non-flammable ground covering. Instead of burning, you can dispose of landscape debris through chipping or hauling to a biomass, energy, or green waste facility. For more information on how to create defensible space, on how to be prepared for wildfires, as well as tips to prevent them, you can visit alertsandiego.org. This is Miriam Raftery on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice.
This is John Tidwell with a sports report. A native of El Cajon will join more than 250 seriously wounded, ill, and injured service members and veterans at the Department of Defense Warrior Games Challenge June 21st through the 30th at ESPN Wide World of Sports in Orlando, Florida. Retired Navy Operations Specialist First Class Travis Wyatt will be competing against athletes representing the U.S. Army, Marine Corps, Air Force, Space Force, and Special Operations Command. During the 10 days of competition, Wyatt will compete in archery, cycling, field, and shooting. The games are hosted by the U.S. Army Training and Doctrine Command and organized by the Department of Defense as an annual elite adaptive sports competition. Wyatt was injured in the explosion on the USS Bonhomme Richard in San Diego in July 2020. Though he was on the USS Fitzgerald nearby, Wyatt was knocked into a bulkhead. The percussive blast resulted in multiple injuries, including more than one traumatic brain injury. This year is the 14th anniversary of the Warrior Games, highlighting the exceptional physical skills and mental toughness of seriously wounded, ill, and injured active duty and veteran service members. Though there are medals distributed during Warrior Games, the competition most highly celebrates personal tenacity, perseverance, and the triumph of the spirit.
This concludes today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technician, Jonathan Getz, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia and the Smashing Beats, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, A.K. Jewel, Brian Boyko, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road, Blues 3 Music, and Pond 5. If you would like to underwrite or sponsor the East County Magazine radio show, or get involved as a volunteer on our public interest news show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We'll be back soon with another edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, bringing you public interest news from our region.